Hey there, teachers. I'm Amy Chaplin, and this is the Piano Pantry Podcast. While this podcast is a solo production, it's supported by a lovely crew of teachers in my Patreon community. A special shout out to one of my supporters, Kate Campbell, who is also an alumnus of the online digital organization course. Thanks so much to Kate for chipping in to keep this work going for our community. If you, like Kate, enjoy the content here, you can join at either the $4 or $7 per month levels. Visit pianopantry.com/Patreon for more details. If you're one of my Patreon supporters or a digital organization alumni, I'll be contacting you soon about connecting for dinner at the upcoming 2024 Music Teachers National Conference in Atlanta. And you know I'll pick someplace good to eat, so stay tuned. Again, that's pianopantry.com/Patreon. In less than 2 weeks, hundreds of teachers will be gathering in Atlanta, Georgia for 5 days of music teacher fun, which brings me to today's guest. Irish-born pianist Peter Mack is in demand throughout the world as a performer, clinician, convention artist, adjudicator, and teacher. He lives in Seattle, Washington, and is the current president of Music Teachers National Association. I am confident you are going to be absolutely delighted by my conversation with Peter as we cover a variety of topics on teaching and life, including teaching specialties, Peter's natural knack for using visual descriptors, what it's like to be on a conference planning committee, tips on the proposal submission process, and much, much more. Enjoy! Well, welcome, Peter. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today. Could you just take a moment and introduce yourself to the listeners?
Well, hi, Amy. I am Peter Mack. I am a 62-year-old teacher from Ireland originally, but I now live in Seattle, Washington, and I teach some students, and I give talks, and I go to states, and I speak at state conventions, and I am also right now the president of MTNA, the Music Teachers National Association here in America.
Wonderful. Do you mind me asking, how long have you lived in the U.S.?
I came in 1984. So what is it? Oh, that's 40 years. I've been here for 40. So, and you know, you're supposed to replace your cells after, I think it's maybe 7 or 8 years. So I have been an American in that all my cells have been regenerated for 33 years.
So I met you at the 2016 Ohio MTA State Conference at Kent State. And I remember it so vividly. It was actually my very early days of ever going out and presenting myself. And my first impression of you was that you had a fabulous knack for visual descriptors. And actually, believe it or not, you probably won't be surprised by this, but I still have my notes from that conference tucked away in the back end of my Evernote app that I use for all that kind of stuff. And I was going through it and my memory served me well because your sessions were titled The Art of the Phrase, and this one's my favorite, Lower the Rear End of the Elephant Slowly into the Keys, Teaching Basic Artistic Concepts by Using Colorful Imagery. Sure enough, I had notes from all your sessions, and you had all kinds of interesting descriptors about toothbrushes and hairbrushes and mud and pizza and gorillas and lawnmowers, and I remember that so well. So I'm curious if that is a key element in your teaching style. Are you known for colorful imagery?
I think the answer without a doubt is yes. I find that we've all, you know, when you say toothbrush or hairbrush or stuff, we all know what it's like to squeeze toothpaste from a tube. We can all imagine the rear end of an elephant being lowered onto piano keys. It's a way of getting through. If I just say to you, I want you to play this louder, that's basically useless. I remember I had one teacher who was a very good teacher, but they said in masterclass, so they would basically teach a lesson. And the lesson that they would teach, they would sit beside the student and point to things in their music, in the score of the music, and say, here, you need to do more of this. And as a lesson, it was fabulous, but as a masterclass, it was really not very good. So I decided that if ever I got up in front of a group of people, I would be as extrovert and I would use as many colorful images as I possibly could. And that just snowballed because it was really, really successful. The talk, what I should explain what the rear end of the elephant is all about. The idea is that what makes a loud sound when you play the piano, and how do the keys go down when you want it to be loud or when you want it to be softer? And usually people will say something like more force or more weight. And so I say, imagine you have a giant elephant and you are lowering its rear end very, very, very slowly onto the keys. Will the notes even sound? And they say, no, they won't. And I say, will the piano break? And they say, yes, it is. So it's not the volume. And then it's the speed. And then I say, I have, and this is a mean analogy, I have a gerbil gun. And a gerbil is this tiny little rodent. And it fires the gerbil onto the piano keys and they go down really fast. Will they sound really loudly? And yes, they will. Will it be horribly sad for the poor gerbil? Yes, it will also. So we don't. But that's the nice thing about thought experiments. You don't have to worry. I had a teacher in Cincinnati, my teacher, Bela Shiki, who was a wonderful teacher and one of the many teachers I've had. He was on sabbatical for one semester. And the teacher who took on some of his students was called Santos Ojeda. And Santos Ojeda had been a Rosina Levine student, so he had a really big, good pedigree. And he was full of fabulous analogies. He really was. And it's the sort of one of the sadnesses is you are ready to hear things when you are ready to hear things. And I had come to Cincinnati to study with Bela Shiki, and then Bela Shiki wasn't there for the first quarter. And I was, oh, it's not Bela Shiki, it's not Bela Shiki. And I studied with Santos Ojeda, who was a very nice man, and we got on very well and so on. But I was waiting. I was just waiting for Bela Shiki. And so then Bela Shiki comes, he's wonderful. He moved to Seattle almost immediately. And so eight students moved with him because he was such a great teacher. But I was 30 years later, I was looking at music that I had studied with Santos Ojeda, and I was thinking, this is wonderful. All the things he had written, they were so great. They were, and I thought, what, how, I felt so guilty because I hadn't appreciated him. I mean, you know, we got on really well, and I said he was a good, but I never really believed that he was a great teacher because I was waiting for the glory of Bela Shiki. And now I realize that Santos Ojeda was a really good teacher as well, but he had died. And so I thought I should write to him and say how great he was and how much I appreciated that semester. But so if you do, I guess there are two lessons to be learned from that. One of them is always be aware that you might be getting something from somewhere you didn't expect. And then if you do get something from any of your teachers, write to them and tell them, because it's so lovely to hear from a student saying that you did wonderful things. It's just, anyway, back to, yes, I do use colorful. And also, as you can see, I hop around from place to place like a frog on a lily pad.
I love that. You know, for me, I think sometimes the difficulty is in the moment coming up with something. Do you kind of have a whole series of stuff that you've used? Of course, I'm sure after 30 years of teaching, you know, you kind of have lots of visual images that you use with different students over and over. But do you find that it comes very naturally to just come up with something on the spot?
Yes, I do. I was just in, I live in Washington State, and we have this wonderful program called the Visiting Artists Program, or the Musical Arts Project or program. And what happens is basically a teacher will go to another place and they will be in residency for 3 days or a week or so on. And they will, and the students of theirs will, the students from that place will play for them. The little ones get 10 minutes and the advanced ones get 30 minutes. And I found that I'm using, there are analogies like the rear end of the elephant. If they don't know how to make the accompaniment softer, they're thinking less weight, or so if you tell them to push the keys down slowly, they're able to do that. And they remember it, I hope, because of the elephant. And then you draw, there's a sheet, a comment sheet that you do. And the comment sheet, I drew a picture of an elephant, not particularly beautifully, but just so that they will remember the elephant is on the piano keys. And yes. So, and then if they're little ones and they play and it's all very, very flat, you know, na, na, ni, 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 which is, you know, they got all their notes right, and there's nothing wrong with that except that it's just dull. So then I say, a sports car, what does a sports car sound like? And then I go, yeah. And I say, can you make that noise? And they go, yeah. And they happen in front of an audience. And I say, okay, so everyone in the audience, can you make that? And I do a hand gesture going from one side of my body to the other. And, yeah. And the audience does it. And then invariably, there will be a parent or there will be someone who's on their phone who is not paying attention because they brought the kid there and they're waiting for it to be over. And so I say, even the daddies in the back have to do it. And then, but I don't always do that because I look at the parent and I think, are they going to do it or is it good? And if I judge it correctly, then the reason why I do that is because now the child has heard it four times and they've done it themselves. And then they go, nee, 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 and it works really, really well, or it works. But yes, I find, especially when I'm in that kind of situation where I want to make huge impact over 10 minutes, that I use the same analogies all over and over again. If I'm teaching my own kids, they've heard the sports car crescendo. They know about the elephant. They know. So you can't use the same things over and over again. So you have to do new things.
True. Yeah. They force you to be continuously creative, right?
I literally came back yesterday from being a visiting artist in a place that I had been to 11 years ago. And what was a little sad is that I remembered, I mean, I did the same dog and pony show, the same, you know, sports car crescendo, the same things that I had taught 11 years ago. And I'm thinking, and the teachers are there. The teachers are looking at, and I'm thinking, first off, they've seen me do this before. They must think that I only have one trick up my sleeve, or that I'm a one trick pony or something. And on the other hand, I'm thinking, I've done all this. I did this last time I came, even if it was a decade ago. Why didn't they change? And it brings us back to my lessons with Santos Ojeda, where I guess they just weren't ready to hear it when I was there the first time.
So I recently listened to your podcast episode where you interviewed Tim Topham, who's going to be the keynote speaker at the upcoming Music Teachers National Conference in Atlanta, which, by the way, I thought that was a fun turnaround for you to actually interview him.
Uh-huh.
And at one point, you were chatting about both the joy of being the type of teacher who can take a student from age 4 to advanced competitions and mold them and refine them, as well as the flip side of being a teacher that hones in on a level of student that you specialize in. And actually, your conversation made me think of an article by Australian-based teacher Samantha Coates. She wrote it maybe a couple of years ago. It was called "What's Your Teaching Specialty?" And in that article, she kind of made me feel permission to say that sometimes it's okay to be the kind of teacher that says, yes, I can teach an advanced level student. I can teach beginners. However, this is my joy and this is my strength, you know, and this is where I want to focus my teaching. So for her example was, you know, she specializes in transfer students and she loves teaching, you know, intermediate level students and transfers. But once they get to a certain level, you know, of advancement, she's ready to pass them on to somebody that specializes in, you know, more advanced level repertoire on a regular basis. And that was very freeing for me. I've only done that a couple of times, but I think there's not one right or wrong answer to be the type of teacher. Maybe you're the type of teacher that starts, you know, kids from age 4 and you can take them all the way and, you know, be confident in that and see the beauty in that and be able to mold them. But it's also okay to be the kind of teacher that knows when it's time to pass on a student to maybe another teacher that would be better suited for them where they are in the moment. So What's your teaching specialty? Do you prefer to just focus on the upper levels, or do you enjoy taking them from, very beginner through advanced?
I know Samantha Coates and she's wonderful. And yes, I read that and I absolutely agree that it, well, first off, I live in a major metropolitan area. I live in Seattle. And one of the things about Seattle that right now, and this is if you are listening and you're thinking, I want to live somewhere in the United States, but I can't decide where to come to Seattle, come to, especially if you have enough money that you can get yourself situated. It's an expensive city to start out in, but there are students here crawling out of the woodwork. I mean, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. It's a city that is thriving. It's a city that is growing. So I went with my studio. I could teach more of, I don't have to restrict myself. I could take anything, any kind of student that I want because they exist. If you live in a town of 340 people, you're not going to be able to say, I only teach the advanced repertoire because you'll have a tiny, tiny number, if anyone, to choose from. So assuming that you can choose, I have nothing but the greatest respect for people who start kids. And I think that is, it's a special skill. It is the hardest thing to do. It's just, I find it exhausting. I am not particularly good at it, even though I try. Where I am is I take transfer students. I take students who are, as you talked about, Samantha Coates. If Samantha Coates gave me a student, I would be thrilled because I take students and I don't have a very big student. In fact, I would say I have a very small studio because I say to them, the people coming in, that you really only have to do one thing to be in my studio, and that's you have to practice a minimum of 2 hours a day, 3 hours on weekends. And that just cuts down on the people that don't want to do the kind of work that I am able to do or that I like doing.
So in my notes that I took from your sessions at the 2016 conference that I mentioned at the start of our conversation, I found a quote from you that I wrote down and I just love. You said, too much of a good thing is wonderful. And I'm like, now that I know you a little bit better, I'm like, oh, that is so Peter. And I love that. And of course, it depends on what context you're talking about. I mean, if you're talking about ice cream, well, eventually that's not going to be a good thing. But that brings me to a personal question. On this podcast, I try to focus on living life as an independent teacher. So what's one thing for you in everyday life that's a good thing that you can't get too much of? It could be a hobby, a favorite food, a favorite composer, adventurous outings, anything like that.
I think your listeners will see the photograph of me in my kitchen. And you see a bunch of things. But one of the things is that just there's too much stuff. My house is full of objects, of things, of brightly colored, shiny things that I pick up and look at and that I love. And it's also full of plants. I really enjoy plants and I get a great kick out of taking them and keeping them alive and propagating them. And then one of the things I do at the Seattle Music Teachers Association is I have a cactus collection. And in Seattle, you can't have cacti outdoors in the winter, but you do put them outside in the summer. And some of them, when I put them outside in the summer and take them inside in the winter, bits drop off them. Bits are broken. And so I always set those in pots and they grow. And then I bring them to the Seattle meetings so that the cacti can go everywhere. And there was a teacher called Willard Schultz who lived in Seattle, and he lived to be, I think, 96. And he had a very ascetic life, except one room in his house was given over to a particular kind of cactus from China called a tanhua that would bloom these huge blooms one night only, and then they would fade. And they have this horrible smell, but this glorious bloom. And so it's sort of the, I think as teachers, we like to nurture things and they and hope that they bloom and give out, well, maybe not give out a horrible smell, but so I love stuff. When I grew up in a house where books were everything. And there were rooms in the house where if you opened the door, if a pile of books had fallen over, you couldn't get, it would be difficult to open the door because the door would be against the pile of books that had fallen over. And I resolved that when I had my own house, that you would not have that, that I would have a Japanese aesthetic and it would be a low bench with one vase at the end of it, with one flower that was delicately spotless and just was going to be... Actually, it was going to be like what your house looks like, because I see it's sort of it's the minimalist, beautiful, restrained. And in my house, there are rooms where sometimes it's hard to get in because piles of books have you can't fight your upbringing, I think.
I wish I could say I was a plant person as well. That's one of those things that's kind of I'm a plant wannabe, but I try and I feel like I always fail. Every time I try to grow a living plant, and I don't know what it is, but I keep trying, and that's the important thing.
Cacti are your friend.
Succulents, too. I do have a succulent that I've had for several years that is still going, so.
Yes, and we were talking earlier, before we started, when we were just chatting, we were talking about doing things like growing avocados and growing citrus from seed. And it's fun to things. I mean, you can, when you go down the vegetable aisle, you can, there are things that are kind of fun to grow, like put an onion in the ground. They have these big flowers that come up, and then they have tiny, tiny, little onion flowers up at the top. So, you know, you don't have to eat all your onions. They are bulbs that will make flowers. And then you can take them and you can bread them and deep fry them.
Well, my husband does all the gardening, and then I do the cooking of the food that he grows.
Yes.
It works pretty well.
So grow onions and you lightly dust them with flour. The flowers, you lightly dust them with flowers, and then you can anyway, that's, we're being a little.
Well, part of the reason I wanted to have you on this episode is the 2024 MTNA conference in Atlanta, Georgia is coming up. And I actually had your predecessor, Karen Thixton, on exactly 100 episodes ago. She was on episode number 10, and that was in March of 2022 when MTNA was still playing it safe and having the online conferences. Now, I don't know if you remember this or not. It's funny, the sometimes things in life that stick with us, but three of my teacher friends, Joy Morin, Jana Williamson, and Christina Whitlock, all gathered in my home during that conference so that we wouldn't be alone totally. And I don't remember how it happened or what the session was, but I think you were hosting a coffee hour with maybe Martha Hilly or something like that. And I think it was like right after my 20-minute tidying tips session. And you and Martha, you verbalized something either about my session or about me and the girls being together. And we just all went crazy. Peter Mack mentioned us. Peter Mack. It's one of those silly little moments. But anyways, that is one of those things for me that is a reason why I'm a part of a group like MTNA. It's about being a part of a group of people. I mean, everybody's reasons are different, you know. Some people want tangibles. They want like, what am I going to get out of it for my membership? Am I going to get, you know, discounts on conferences or like what resources am I going to get in trade? But for me, I just need the community of teachers. And, you know, piano teacher world isn't that small, but if you engage enough, you start to get to know people and you start to see the same people. And I believe with my whole heart that it's those relationships and connections that can make or break sometimes teachers hanging on to this career, because it can be such a lonely career. So what say you? Do you agree? What is your favorite part of being a member of MTNA?
I absolutely agree. There are so many different areas, places we could go. I remember the first time I heard you speak, I think also was at that or that Ohio conference back, and it was, did you say 2016? Is that, yes. Yes, that's right. That's when it was, because I remember the election was just about to happen. And you are so wonderful. I remember and your session was packed. And I even remember what the room was like. It was a low room it wasn't long. It was wide. It was weird.
Yeah, and I remember that too.
And but I remember, I mean, you were just so, your session was sort of, whoa, I could do that. That's why I should. And of course, now I'm thinking, I took so many notes and there were so many great ideas that I must put into practice one of these days.
I remember feeling that joy after my session. You came up to me and complimented me, and I was like, oh my goodness, Peter Mack likes my session.
I didn't want to say that because I didn't want to put you on the spot and say, did you remember that I went up? Of course, you know, why should she remember? But in a sense, though, that's one of the things that I think that I'm going to get when I go to a conference is I'll go to these wonderful sessions and I'll take these great notes and I'll go around the exhibit hall and I'll buy all this fabulous music that I can't wait to teach. And I hear music being played in sessions and I go to the concerts and I see the masterclasses and I do all that. But I do all that stuff and I enjoy all that stuff. But I mean, I've already described my house as having piles of things all over the place. I have piles of music from sessions that I went to years ago that I think, oh, yes, I must go through that sometime and pick out the thing. I have piles of notes that I took at sessions that that I'm like, oh, I should go through those. And there were some really good ideas there. But the thing that I really get from going to the convention is just, as you say, the feeling of not being alone, that we are all there and we are all doing it together. And I love that. That's the thing. And that's the thing that I get from my local chapter in Seattle as well. There are some people who just join because of competitions. They never go to a meeting and they never send their students to, no, they all they do is they send their students to competitions and sometimes they don't even show up to the competitions. And for them, being an MTNA is simply the price of admission so that your students can do competitions. When I taught college, our meetings used to be in Seattle, used to be on Tuesday mornings. I never could go. And so for 30 something years, I was a member and I couldn't go. I went to national conferences way before I went to meetings in Seattle, just because I couldn't. But now I can. And it's what I love about going to Seattle is it's a chapter with two social directors. And what that means is there are two people and they're just the most extrovert, lovely people. And if they're not extroverts, they pretend really well. And their job or the task that they have set themselves is to find stuff for us to do. And sometimes it's obvious stuff, like if there's a recital or someone's playing with the symphony, or most recently we went to hear X, The Life and Time is that opera. And so doing things that you think, yes, a music teacher's group, that's something that obviously they're going to do. But they went on a Halloween pub crawl and they have brunch in a restaurant that's on the water. We went to a place where you paint. It's like painting by numbers for adults with alcohol. And we do that kind of stuff as well. And I love it because I get to spend time not talking about, you know, my little student, she's just done, but talking about what it's like to have a studio and what it's like to be a business person in 2024, rather than being in my little room teaching my student and then putting down the piano lid and walking away and my life being separate from it. I love the amalgamation of my life outside music with my life inside music.
Well, that's so fun hearing about your group. I love, like, I've never heard of a group doing something besides just gathering and having sessions together or something like that. I mean, like, my group has done lunch together, but to actually go out and just have fun, like just to go to an opera or to do something like that. That's so special. So the cool thing about conferences to me is that no one experiences everything exactly the same. There are so many things to do, right? Your MTNA conference is going to look totally different than my MTNA conference here in a couple of weeks. So what are some highlights for you that's on the agenda?
It's funny you say your MTNA conference, because it's not my MTNA conference. It's actually Vanessa Cornett Mertada. Conference of Vanessa Cornett, because every year MTNA, one of the perks of being a president is that you get to choose somebody who does things, and so you get to choose the person who is the conference planning chair, and then you work together with them and with the MTNA staff to pick people who represent different interests in the organization, and together then you put the conference together. And what happens is that this year I think we had 583 proposals, and of those 583 we were able to squeeze in about 100. And those 100 proposals, I mean, they're wonderful. It's this, but next year it will be Noreen Wengen, who is from California and who is independent teacher par excellence. And she wrote the book called The 2-Year Waitlist. And she's a wonderful teacher, but she's also very much business oriented. And so her conference is going to look completely different. And sometimes people say to me, you know, I applied and I didn't get in. What should I do for next time? And one of the answers is, you know, if you do the same proposal, if it was a good proposal, next year will be the color of the conference will be totally different from the conference before. But what am I really looking forward to? Well, one of the things I was able to do, of course, is to choose the people who give teaching demonstrations, masterclasses. We have our conference artist, Sean Chen, and he's at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And also he won Van Cliber, and he was a huge prize winner there. And he's a stunning pianist, but he's also a lovely masterclass giver. And I did something at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and he was there. And he was like, oh, we got to have him do something. And then the other people, who else is there? Well, I judged the Texas state competition, maybe MTNA competition, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And there was one studio where these students are amazing, up one after another, and it was the McDonald studio. And it's Alex McDonald and his mother, Marcy McDonald. And when you see something being incredibly well done, you want to find out how it's done. And so I asked them to give a joint masterclass. And she said no, and he said yes. And it's sort of like, that's not what I want. I wanted you both. And what's lovely is that finally she has said yes. I think he talked her into it, or I don't know what it was that made her change her mind. But what I'm hoping with that session, and they're giving the intermediate class, what I'm hoping with that session that will happen is that she will say, blah, 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 and he will say, oh, mom, you always and you know, he will say, blah, 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 and she will say, now, Alex, you know, that's just not so. And
that's
so
funny, yeah.
We had the Angela Cheng and Alvin Chow, who are a married couple, do that maybe 2 years ago or something. And it was so great because they love each other and they're really stunning musicians, but they didn't always agree. And it's so, and I had the Weems, Nancy and John Weems, do that. Again, a husband and wife. And this is the first time I've ever seen a mother and son give a masterclass. I'm really looking forward to that. And then we have a junior masterclass, and that's being given by Kevin Olson. And Kevin Olson, and he brings his students to MTNA conferences, and he writes pieces that fall so easily under the hand that the students think that they are better than they are, but they are, because they're able to play fabulous. We're really excited about it. He's coming. And then there's a new masterclass that I always wanted. The thing that I'm most inadequate, well, there are lots of things I'm most inadequate about, but the thing in teaching that I feel the most inadequate about is technique. And if there is a lecture on a talk on technique at the conference, it's packed always, because I think I am not the only one that feels that they wished that they were more secure in technique. I mean, having said that, you know, the Russians, they feel they've got it down, and the Taubman people, they feel they've got it down. But the us mortals, we just, I wish that I knew more about technique. And so if there was a session that said, this is technical advice, this is what you should do, then I think that would be hugely, hugely popular. And I'm hoping it will be, because we have Dr. Teresa Bogart, who is the professor at the University of Wyoming. She is perhaps the best technical diagnostician that I have ever seen in my life. And what happens is someone will play for her, and just play like 20 seconds, and she will look at them and she will say, do you realize that every time you go playing two octaves above middle C, you kink your shoulder up like that? And if you didn't kink your shoulder up, you would be so much more, or you're moving your wrist too much, or you're sitting too low, or why are you dipping your wrist every time you play E flat? Or, I mean, just, I've no idea what she does that is so magical, because it's what she does that's so magical, but she's going to do that. And we have, I think, three or four people lined up to play for her. But what I don't want is that the whole class is just those three or four people playing for her. What I want is that the first one plays and she says, blah, 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 done with you. Next one, blah, 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 done with you. And then goes. And then when the fourth person has played, she looks at the audience and there is a big, long line of people who want to play for her. And she goes, well, now you should do blah. And then the next one, you should do blah. And it's almost a conveyor belt. It's wonderful. I mean, she changes lives, you know. I'm talking too much.
There's so many amazing things. I mean, how do you leave any of it out, you know?
Please. And did I mention there are 100 presentations?
I know. You know what you said at the beginning about how every conference is different, and, you know, whoever is planning it, there's different goals and, you know, what they're looking for. And you're 100% right. And actually, I'm doing a session at MTNA, which is on how to craft winning proposals and engaging presentations. But it's true. One of the things that I reiterate in that session is that you can't know, just because a proposal wasn't accepted one for a conference doesn't mean it wasn't good. It would just may not be what they were looking for that one, you know? So you have to submit to lots of different things. Even that proposal that I'm doing for MTNA, that session, it's been rejected by other state, you know, conferences and stuff. So it's like, you never know.
I don't know if Zoom was able to capture the fact that I burst out laughing when you said it, because you reminded me of the fun that we had when we talked about your session in the planning committee.
I want to hear this.
Yes, well, it was sort of, we could reject it, and we could, I mean,
right.
It would be so fun to reject to have, but it's, I mean, there are so many things. One of them is, you're a really good presenter. We've all been to see you present. You are organized. You have tip-top information. You deliver it in a way that is visually as well as orally interesting. I mean, it's you really present extremely well.
Well, thank you so much.
That topic is a topic that I don't know anyone has done. And of course, everybody who is there who has been rejected wants to know why. And sometimes, and now that I have sort of seen the sausage made, one of the things that I was very lucky, because the first time I did a national proposal at MTNA, I was accepted. Yay, I was accepted.
My very first one.
Aren't we wonderful? And the second time, I was accepted, and it was like, oh, I know how to do this. This is great. I'm so yay. And the third time I was rejected. And it was I think it was even my Art of the Phrase one, which is one of the best ones I give. And I was like, no, this is even better than last year's. How could you reject me? And then one of my friends that was on the planning committee, and after we've had a few drinks or something, I sort of vaguely, gingerly maneuvered the conversation to, how could I make my next year better? And she said, oh, it was a great proposal. It's just you'd given twice in a row. We can't have you every year. Are you crazy? And I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's something as simple as that, you know, but yes. You don't know. And that's why it's hard, because you can't get that feedback, understandably, when there's 500 proposals, you know.
Yes.
I can't share with you why.
Yes, that's one of the things is that we try. And so, you know, Ingrid Clairfield is a really good presenter and a really good friend of mine. And sometimes I've been in things where I reject her simply because she gave it last year. And she's like, but my session is so wonderful. You heard me give it in the New Jersey conference when you were there. And I was like, yes, I did hear you give it at the New Jersey conference. And you are wonderful. And it was a wonderful session. We can't have you every year, even though it would be wonderful if we did, simply because everyone, we want to have as varied a conference. And we want to have people like... When you and I were our first time, if we have only established people, then it's lovely, but it's stagnant.
I agree. Yeah. Everybody has to have a chance, and you have to have balance and variety. And, you know, and like you said, you know, this topic is something that nobody really talks to you about, which is why I wanted to present on it. And part of me was a little bit like, well, I've never actually been on a conference committee. So I hope people, but I've also presented a lot too, and I've submitted a lot. So, you know, like nobody else is telling people, so I'm going to give it a shot.
Well, let me tell you actually how, and maybe because maybe first let me say, how organized are you? Have you already got your conference all PowerPointed out, and then you are nodding your head? And
yes, it's done.
So Ingrid and I co-presented Ingrid Clairfield a few years ago, and our friendship took a hit there because we love each other and we respect each other, and we do not work in the same way together. I do things sort of the last minute, you know, the day, a few days before. We have lots of time, and she is like you. And as I look behind you at your house, I thought, when I asked that question, I thought, I know what she's going to answer.
The answer.
Yes. And if you look behind me at my house, you also know the answer.
Predictable, right? Did you present with Ingrid at the conference in Disney?
Anaheim or in
not California. It was in Florida.
Something Park. Or no, it wasn't Winter Park. It was Springs.
It was at Disney World, basically.
Disney World.
I'm pretty sure I saw your guys' session there. It was phenomenal.
And of course, you have two, in that there were two supreme extroverts elbowing each other out of the spotlight, because of course we were, because that's what we were. But what was, where was I going? I was going somewhere. I have a friend called Pam, and she says, land the plane, Peter.
Land the plane.
And what I was going to say is how people were actually chosen. And so I think there were maybe five people on the conference planning committee, and each one of us represents a different thing. So there were independent teacher, sort of person who comes from a business point of view, the chair of, or someone who brings a DEI perspective, someone who is under the age of 754, someone who is the sort of, just you want to have as varied, and it was a great number group of people. But then you get 583 proposals to read, and they are one page proposals, and if there isn't a system, you're going to go, wait, what, that were number 125, which one was that again? And so what we did was we read them, and we could give them a 1, a 2, or a 3. And 1 meant, I don't think we should promote this one. 2 meant, this is pretty good, but could be just fine. And 3 is, I love this one. And then we tabulated our scores. And it was very interesting to see how nice people were. And I was clearly the Grinch, because I was like, we can't have everyone. So I gave a lot of ones, I gave a few twos, and I gave a small number of threes, because otherwise, what's the point? If you're nice to everybody and you give everybody threes, well, that's nice, but you might as well not have been there.
So you were the Simon Cowell of
I was
of the conference committee.
I'm thinking that maybe this is not what I should be saying at all.
No, I think this is good. And I think that's interesting to know how they rate things. I mean, you said you have to have a system or it's going to be chaos.
There's another strategy that someone says, well, how can I make it accepted next time? And one of the things you can do is you can send two or three proposals in, and don't send the same proposal in three times. Like, you know, interesting piano music from 20th century Bolivian women composers, piano music from 20th century Argentinian women composers, piano from 20th century Jamaican women composers, because that's basically the same program over and over. And so send more, you know, do one of them piano with 20th century Argentinian women composers, and then another one being 10 ways that I organize my studio so that my taxes are done with at the every quarter. And also, if it was something like interpretative choices in the Gulbenkian flute sonata, that there are so few people who at the conference who are going to play the Gulbenkian flute sonata, that even if it's a wonderful proposal, it's probably not going to get chosen. So those are sort of things to consider: the process, the fact that you can spread your net widely and you don't have to put all your eggs in one basket. And then remember that if it's too narrow in focus, it's probably not going, you want it to reach at least a minimum number of people.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And thank you. You're helping me with my own session. I can say I talked to one of the, you know, the conference plan people, and they've confirmed. I don't think you're not giving away the bank. Don't worry. I think this was great. And I think people are going to really appreciate hearing that. So as we come into our final question, Peter, you know me well enough to know I share a lot about productivity and organization. Is there anything particular that helps you in your daily workflow, whether that be a habit or a resource or a tool that you want to share with us?
I can share a belief that I do not always follow. So yesterday I got 209 emails, and that is welcome. You know, I mean, it won't, when I stop being president of MTNA, that won't continue, but that is where we are right now. I used to answer emails beautifully, and I would, and then if something came that, that's someone I like very much, I'm going to take a bit of time with that one, then I would put it away and sort of never get back to it. And that was the thing, is that sort of, I think it's better to do a quick reply or a quick solution that is done, especially if you have many, many things to do. It's better to do a quick solution that is done rather than a beautiful, elegant solution that is never done. I mean, I was not great at replying to you. And I replied and I said, yes, I'd love to. And then you sent me a thing saying, okay, great, let's do it. And then I didn't reply to that. And you were like, are you sure you want to do it? And then I'm like, oh, yes, I do. I do. And with practicing, it's the same thing that I find, that it's way better that I do 10 minutes of practice rather than just a 10 minute little bit, and then another 10 little bit something rather. And I try and do that every day rather than doing a beautiful 2.5 hour practice session. Never.
Yeah, I agree. And like you said, even with email, like sometimes if you want to think on something a little bit more, you can at least send an initial response that says, hey, I acknowledge your email. You know, I'm going to think about this and get back to you at least, or something, you know, like at least you have a quick solution and you know that you've actioned it.
And the corollary to that is, if I didn't get back to you, please don't take it personally. It's that you were number 208 and I like you so much that I wanted to give it thought. And then the next day's 209 emails came.
Right. Yeah, yes. It's crazy. And that's why I'll put a plug here. That's why I do my digital coaching for teachers. I have a retreat that actually the dates just opened up. I do a retreat in my home for teachers on digital organization. And they come together and I talk them through like mindset and cleanup and upkeep of digital workspaces, like your email, your file management, media, like all kinds of stuff like that, that we deal with as teachers. That's not, has nothing to do with teaching, but still like runs our lives. So yeah, there's my little plug for that.
I remember you talked about that in Ohio way back when, about cleaning up your email. And I just went to look at my email and I have 77,301 unread messages.
Oh my goodness. Well, Peter, you need my course.
Is it online?
I do two versions. Yeah, I do an in-person retreat and then I do an online version as well. Peter, it has been such a lovely time chatting with you. I look forward to seeing you in person at the conference here in a couple of weeks. And I just appreciate you taking the time to share with us today.
Thank you so very much for inviting me to do it. I am honored to be here. And I'm looking forward to your session in a very, very short while. And I'm so glad that it was the unanimous choice of the actually, it's funny because I thought that would be a cute thing to say. You were not the unanimous choice of the group. And I know that not because I remember your proposal, but because nobody, there was not one proposal that was the unanimous choice of the five members of the selection committee. And on the one hand, it's like it was nobody good enough. On the other hand, I think what's great about that is that it really shows that we tried to do a diversity of opinions, a diversity of people coming from a different walks of life or different kinds of teachers in as part of the planning committee. And so you were not the unanimous choice of all the members of the committee, but you were mine.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I feel very special. All right. Well, we'll see you here soon, Peter. Have a great day.
I look forward to it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening in today, everyone. I have three quick announcements for you before we go. First of all, as Peter and I discussed, I'll be premiering a new 20-minute session at the upcoming conference called The Wow Factor, Crafting Winning Proposals and Engaging Presentations. That will be held on Monday, March 18th at 2:55 p.m. I hope to see you there. Second, as I briefly mentioned in our conversation, dates have been announced for the 2024 Piano Pantry Retreat in my home in Indiana. There will only be one retreat date this year, which will be held on June 12th through 15th. Since I can only accept a very small number, the spots are actually almost already full after announcing to those on my first notification list and email subscriber list in just the past week. Now, registration isn't closed, so you can still submit your interest. It's just getting very close to being closed already. If you would like to join the first notification list for the retreat or subscribe to my email list so you can be notified of this special exclusive event sooner in the future, please see the link in the show notes or visit pianopantry.com/retreat. Lastly, the two-day workshop, Organize Your Life with Notion, is happening this weekend on March 8th and 9th, 2024. If you missed the early bird deadline for $40 off, we've just released a last chance discount for 3 days only for $30 off through Wednesday, March 6th. Visit pianopantry.com/notion. As always, anything mentioned today can be found in the show notes at pianopantry.com/podcast/episode 110.